Now, gender increasingly is a fluid thing. Boys, girls, everything around and in between. How does that idea, that loose construct, how does that sit with the world of fashion? How does an industry that has traditionally drawn lines of gender with sharp distinction adjust to a world that's moved on from pink for girls and blue for boys? Can clothes be gender neutral? Can clothes just be clothes? All of which raises the interesting question of how clothes came to be so rigorously gendered in the first place. Answers, please. To join us, Professor Jo Paletti. She's author of Pink and Blue, Telling the Boys from the Girls in America, and joins us from the US via Skype. And in Sydney, Glynis Trail-Nash, fashion editor from The Australian. Jo, can I start with you? And let's take this back to that sort of origin story. When did, and this is a bit of a shorthand for a broader thing, but when did society start dressing girls in pink and boys in blue?
Well, it's surprisingly recent, because even though in Europe there were some places where sometimes these colors were gendered, they really didn't become a common practice in the United States until the 20th century. And even when I was a little girl in the 1950s, pink was not a forbidden color for boys, nor was it the preferred color for girls. I hardly ever wore pink myself, just because probably my mother didn't care for the way it looked on me. And so it doesn't become this expectation where girls are just surrounded with pink from before they're born until the mid-1980s.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, that is so recent. But the look at childhood, that whole idea of little girls and little boys, that was a thing which just came into being, I think, in the 19th century, that distinction began to be made for small children.
Yeah, I mean, the Pink and Blue book is essentially just about babies and toddlers, because I was looking at an age group where 150 years ago, there were no gender distinctions made in the way they were dressed, mainly because, not because people thought that boys and girls were the same or they were equal or whatever, but because they felt that children at that age should not be aware of sex differences. And that it wasn't appropriate to draw attention to them.
Well, this is the interesting thing now, that we have a culture which increasingly is redefining its constructs around gender and gender identity. And that, of course, is going to play out in how parents dress their children. This is going to become a much more ambiguous thing, I would say.
Well, for some parents, yes. I think that's one of the things that's creating this current kind of churn and turmoil around the idea of gender. There are still many, many people who really, truly believe that there's two sexes, male and female, and that the gender roles appropriate to each should be different and distinct. And then you have parents who are saying, well, this is all a cultural construct, and these very highly defined gender roles are not healthy for children, and they should be permitted more choice and more expression. And then you have everyone in between, of course.
Yes, it is an area we shouldn't underestimate or underplay, the amount of social division around these ideas. And Glynis, in the middle of that sits a fashion industry struggling to dress everybody.
Well, that's a whole other question, really, isn't it? I mean, there's so many things around about diversity in fashion at the moment, but specifically in terms of gender identity in fashion, it is a big talking topic at the moment. We've seen actually, you know, a number of the big luxury brands even get on board with this, which was quite interesting, like Balenciaga and Gucci particularly, which tends to be quite flamboyant though, you know. So there is this, it kind of follows on from that kind of peacocky thing for guys where you can dress in a more flamboyant manner. So that's one part of it. Then we've got this real millennial drive, and this is where it is really interesting, because that whole concept of unisex clothing, which could be worn by either person, it tends to be quite often quite oversized, quite, can I say, bland at the moment, though. It's quite driven by streetwear, and that's obviously quite youth-focused itself. But the other thing that's interesting about it is with this millennial drive, there are often brands that are also very ethically minded and very sustainably minded. So you've got all these things kind of coming together.
It's very complicated.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But
A thought here for both of you. I mean, and when we're looking at that idea of gender neutrality in clothing, in fashion, I wonder whether that accepts a certain amount of male fashion as an agreed baseline. And here's an example, a pair of jeans, gender neutral, but a sort of fundamentally male. Why do we not have a gender neutral skirt, for example?
Kilts.
Yes, there's kilts, Glitters.
The exception
Love a man
proves
in a kilt.
The rule.
Well, is that true, Joe? Is that an exception there which proves the rule? I think there is something about maleness being accepted as the neutral position.
Well, it's also the more powerful position. So for a long, long time, it's been acceptable for women and girls to either adopt elements of clothing that are male clothing, or to pursue hobbies or sports that are predominantly male, but it is not acceptable and for a lot of people for men to imitate women or to do what women would like to do. The short version of the explanation is that between homophobia and misogyny, it pretty much covers it, that women are less valued and homosexual men are feared. And homosexuality in boys, little boys, is feared. So that it's much more likely for a little girl to be permitted to dress just like a boy than vice versa.
Mm. That plays out into adulthood too, doesn't it, Glynis?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anyone who watched the Oscars this year, I mean, you know, the men's fashion on the red carpet was actually fantastic. But the most, you know, knockout one was, you know, Billy Porter wearing a black velvet tuxedo gown. I mean, that really kind of stopped people in their tracks. And it shocked a lot of people. And it's something that is rare. And it was statement making and all of those things. But it's because it's so uncommon. That's why it was such a big thing, you know, and you don't see it often at all.
I mean, that is such an interesting thing, Joe. And as you said, the psychological reasoning around that is really tough issues, as you say, around misogyny, around homophobia. I mean, it just seems inconceivable that gender neutrality may feminize a common style of dressing, and that says something very profound about us socially.
Yeah. Well, this is why. Actually, clothing is worth studying. Every once in a while, I get the reaction of, oh, that must be fun. And the idea that if you're interested in fashion as a career in some way, you're doing something light. But it's one of the most serious things we do is dress ourselves.
Every day.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Well, every day we have to make a decision.
Even on radio. Glynis, in the retail setting, are we beginning to see a blurring of boundaries? Are retailers creating soft, gender-ambiguous spaces?
Some are. Again, it's still very much in the minority, but it is happening. I read Selfridges a couple of years ago, actually did it was a pop-up section called Agenda with an R on the end, you know, and so that was a very fluid space. It didn't have male or female mannequins, for example, and it had, you know, clothing that could be worn by anyone. Apparently even Abercrombie and Fitch in the US, which I find this astonishing, has started having some gender neutral change rooms. I mean, for a brand like that, I just find that quite incredible, actually, because it's a very masculine brand to my mind, even though they have some women's stuff as well. Even Zara and H&M, those kind of brands, big fast fashion brands, they're tapping into that visually.
I wonder, Joe, I mean, as you explained to us before, the pink blue thing is such a recent development. So social change, cultural change can be quite formative in other attitudes. I wonder, are we noticing around the dressing of children, are we noticing the beginning of a certain gender ambiguity? Is we starting to reverse that trend?
Well, it's interesting when you try to look at what the echoes of children's culture are, because obviously babies don't choose their clothing and toddlers rarely do. So a lot of the interest in neutral clothing today is the people who are in their 20s and 30s. And these are the people who are the first babies and toddlers to be heavily gendered. So in some ways, it might be a reaction to that, because they're certainly not looking to dress their children the same way they were dressed, nor are they necessarily looking to dress themselves in the way they dressed as children. So there's that kind of, it's more of a reverberation, maybe a generation later. I go into department stores and look at the baby section just to see where things are there. And in the big department stores in this area, it's still a huge pink mass on one side and then a huge mass of tiny little pants with lots of pockets on the other side. And this sad little boring section in the middle.
Pockets are the defining characteristic.
Sadly true, yes. But so there's this tiny little display of neutral baby clothes in the middle. So essentially, if somebody wants to defy those gender roles, they either have the sad little boring ungendered clothing, or they have to cross-dress their children.
It's a really deep a deep piece of territory. I think we've fleshed out just slightly in this conversation. There's much more there. However, Joe and Lilith, thank you so much for your time. Professor Joe Paletti, she's Professor Emerita of American Studies at the University of Maryland, author of Plink and Blue, Telling the Boys from the Girls in America, amongst other books, and Glynis Trowell-Nash. Glynis is fashion editor for The Australian. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Blueprint here on RN.